Black and brown communities are so impacted by this mental health crisis, and we don't have enough people trained to really meet Black and brown communities where they are.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University. You're going to see something really incredible. We're not in Pasadena for this particular special episode. I was in Chicago, Illinois, and we had tons of people from all over the country joining us for a very important panel presentation on the state of integrative mental health in America, sponsored by Saybrook University. We featured three nationally known experts: Dr. Kimberly Frazier, president of the American Counseling Association; Dr. C.J. Davis, president and CEO of Burrell Behavioral Health, one of the nation's largest mental health services providers based in Missouri, but all across the Midwest and Upper South; and our own Dr. Donald Moss, scholar and expert in integrative mental health. We peel back the layers to understand with this group the complexities of the nation's mental health crisis with possible solutions for the future. This group of thought leaders sheds important light on what we can and must do to find our way forward to a more balanced, healthy, and supportive society where mental health is concerned.
I want to first start off by thanking Dr. Hamilton and Dr. Moss, who've been instrumental in organizing today. Our guests who are joining us, just as a quick note, this has been an eight-hour affair with a lot of ins and outs and breaks and videos and multimedia all around integrative mental health. And we are pleased to end today with our distinguished guests here, Dr. Frazier and Dr. Davis, which Dr. Hamilton will be providing a little bit of background here. A little bit before we get started, I am sitting right now in a conference room here in Wichita, Kansas. And Wichita, Kansas, at the Kansas College of Medicine, which is a new college in our TCS education system dedicated to integrative health and training the MDs of the future. This is all part of an initiative to really bolster rural and urban healthcare, especially using integrative healthcare techniques. So I kind of find this a serendipitous occasion to be here and be with all of you in this moment. We know that right now, at this moment in our country's history, and I was just reading a bunch of articles on the way out to Wichita, we've had a healthcare crisis, not just since COVID, but for the last 50 years or longer. And it's become so acute at this point. We have a lot of things to unpeel and figure out as a country and in our communities. And so today I'm excited to bring these thought leaders together to help us begin the process of unpacking, identifying, and strategizing ways that we can work together to advance the health and well-being of the communities we serve. And the last thing I'll say is that over the next 2 years, Saybrook University is engaged in an integrative mental health initiative called Integrative Mental Health for All, in which I and faculty, alumni, students will be traveling the country to look at the state of mental health and integrative health, to identify the opportunities, the challenges, and even more importantly, identify partnerships and ways we can work together to improve the health and well-being of these communities, of our fellow citizens. So with that, I am pleased to have this be, and for us to have this be, our inaugural panel to kick off this national campaign. With that, Dr. Hamilton, I will turn it over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, President Long. I do appreciate that. And thank you so much to the panelists for taking time out of your day to be with us. So I would like to start by saying thank you to Dr. Kimberly Frazier. She is American Counseling Association president. I'm so super excited to have her here. Counselor education is my background. So I am very, very happy. Yes, and I've been a member of ACA for about almost 30 years now, so without telling my age. But so thank you so much, Dr. Frazier, for being here. And when we get started, if you all wouldn't mind just sharing a minute or so about yourselves. But I just want to introduce you all. So I'll go to Dr. CJ Davis, and he is the CEO of Burrell Behavioral Health. And thank you so much for being here, Dr. Davis. And then our very own Dr. Donald Moss, he's our Dean of the College of Integrative Medicine and Health Sciences here at Saybrook University. And so he's a longtime Saybrookian. So we're really happy to have this esteemed panel. Unfortunately, one of our guest panelists could not make it. That was Dr. Jim Gordon. We did play his wonderful video, and he's just doing amazing things. He's in Ukraine now and doing just wonderful mission work and all these things to help. So really proud of that. So without further ado, we'll get started with the first question. So we're at an unprecedented moment by some accounts in that we are experiencing a mental health crisis across the United States. So to our panelists, if each of you could describe from your vantage point, what is the scope of the crisis nationally, and what are the specific issues and challenges you're seeing? Let's start with Dr. Frazier.
Thank you. So Dr. Kimberly Frazier, representing the American Counseling Association, but I'm also associate professor at LSU Health Sciences and chair of the counseling department at LSU Health Sciences. So thank you so much for having me here. It's massive. The scope of the crisis is so massive. We don't have enough counselors, mental health professionals to really address the massiveness of the scope of what's happening in mental health. Additionally, Black and Brown communities are so impacted by this mental health crisis, and we don't have enough people trained to really meet Black and Brown communities where they are culturally, or the specific expertise that's needed for those communities. Additionally, there's a stigma associated with just seeking out mental health services. So many people don't know what to look for, the triggers, the behaviors, the things that might be going on before it blows up into a big issue. ACA was afforded the opportunity to go to the anti-stigma campaign with other mental health agencies and organizations. That is out of the Huntsman family out of Utah. They pledged $150 million to get mental health agencies together to kind of work on this very problem of what can we do to erase the stigma that's associated with that. And we were just grateful to sit at the table and talk about the crucial aspect of how do we get rid of that stigma. So again, massive, massive, massive scope. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Frazier. And thank you for letting us know about $150 million committed to that. That's quite a bit of money. So hopefully that will bring a lot of good things in the future.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Any day we have an opportunity to talk about mental health is a good day in my mind. I am on the provider side. So our organization, Brightly, is a joint venture with two other organizations. We serve four states, have about 5,000 employees, making us one of the largest nonprofit providers in the country. Also have federally qualified health centers, behavioral health centers, work with developmental disability services and mental health. So we have a little bit of everything in terms of what we're encountering with the crisis and the demand. Really, we call it the second curve of the pandemic, and we don't expect this to decrease anytime soon in the next couple of years. What does that mean? Typically, the American, about 15% of people will experience a concerning psychiatric symptom. If you look at the data today, it's anywhere between 40 and 50%, which essentially means one out of every two individuals in America are encountering a distressing self-reported psychiatric symptom, and that is really impacting the demand, the door demand on the provider side. So we service over 110,000 people a year. I checked today, we have 3,000 people today in queue for services being scheduled, 3,000 a day. that 3,000 will start all over tomorrow and so on and so forth. So the demand month over month in our industry on the provider side is about 15 to 20% increase. And it's not stopping there. Along with the number of kids that are experiencing suicidal ideation, the prominent features of and presentations clinically are anxiety, depression, and substance abuse. We also see about 15% increase in our crisis calls. We run a large crisis call service, and so seeing a 15% increase in those areas. So it's been pretty interesting. We've had to transform how we've had to deal with this door demand. The care as, you know, as usual, as typical, is no longer finding a psychotherapist, finding a therapist, finding a treatment provider who's going to work with you for 10, 12, 15, 20 sessions. We feel like in some ways is a thing of the past. We have to integrate services at the primary care level. We've had to open up 24/7 crisis centers, urgent care centers, walk-in clinics, and we have to determine when we refer somebody to more specialty services. So on the provider side, the volume's high and the competition for providers is also high. We've already referenced the fact that there's not enough new providers entering into the market. In spite of our efforts of being large and training more over the course of time, that puts a little bit of a dent into it. But outside the low number of providers being trained across our country in terms of meet the demand, there's wage wars that are happening out there. Good news for students that you can go out and find a job and probably leave 6 months later for another job paying $5,000 to $10,000. But that's really bad on the provider side because continuity of care is becoming problematic. I think the third piece of this, when we talk about the mental health crisis right now, is provider burnout. Not only are we having a hard time identifying and hiring new providers, but retention. And not just people leaving our organization, but leaving the field because we've asked them to do more with less for many, many months. And again, the end is probably not in sight.
And training is so expensive. It's such a waste when they leave the field. You know, we put more money into training and then we burn out the providers. I agree with what Dr. Davis and Dr. Frazier have said, and just however we look at it, it's a crisis. Americans hardly agree on anything, and CNN published a survey saying that 9 out of 10 adults at least agree we have a mental health crisis. And then if we look at what's happening with adolescents in disadvantaged communities, it's worse. The Surgeon General said there was a 50% increase in the course of the pandemic in emergency room visits for suicide attempts among girls, a doubling of anxiety and depression for both genders. If you look at drug overdoses, they reached a new peak during the pandemic, suicide rates near a peak last year. And then I talked to a Saybrook graduate last night. She opened a practice a week ago, and she already has a 3-month waiting list. This is a problem.
The other thing is the suicide rates among Black and Brown children is so alarming. It's so alarming. And not enough attention is being put on just that with the attempts, and the follow through is alarming as well. And again, we're not trained. There's not enough people trained to deal with that. And as a professor, you hear students saying that they're afraid to deal with someone who might be suicidal or might even talk about suicide. So we also have to not only talk about the stigma as it relates to clients, we also have to talk about the stigma as it relates to students too, and getting them more prepared and less afraid of dealing with a client who may be suicidal or even talk about suicide.
Thank you, Dr. Frazier, for that. And thank you all for answering that question. And I agree, Dr. Frazier. We were talking earlier in some of our previous sessions today about burnout and about how we can train students differently than we have in the past because of the population and the needs of the population. And so I think you all have touched on that, and that's very meaningful. And we know that we need to do this. And so as educators, I think we can be about that And we could be about that change in a way so that we can reach everyone differently than we have been 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Times are different, very different these days. I think you gave some incredible statistics that just is mind-blowing to hear that a practice, someone started a practice and already it's booming. And then the providers have so many people in the queue already, 3,000 people. What's happening? There is a crisis. So thank you for that answer. Dr. Long?
Yeah, great. Thank you all very much for framing the situation, right, nationally. Very, very helpful and very acute. And hopefully we can find our way out of this and into a new way of being. I was struck by two points that were raised, CJ and Dr. Davis and Dr. Frazier. The first is the changing model, the shifting model, right? I guess my mind had not quite wrapped around the fact that you're looking basically at an embedded therapist within, you know, healthcare, the continuum of healthcare. And Dr. Frazier, your point around Black and Brown children and the high suicide rates and the issues that are attendant there. I really do want to get it. We could probably take 3 or 4 hours to really get into all of this. If we could kind of start with the diversity, equity, and inclusion piece here, because I want to hit that last point that you raised, Dr. Frazier. You know, it is at the center of many discussions, as we know, across the nation in educational and provider settings, critical in how we, you know, really provide care to marginalized populations, as you rightly just noted, and as Dr. Moss, you pointed out as well. In your mind and in our panelists' minds, after we shift over from Dr. Frazier, how would you grade the work right now? It sounds like it's kind of a low grade when it comes to DEI and the professions within this space.
Yes.
And secondly, what can we do to enhance it? You know, in terms of the supply side. So, Dr. Frazier, I'll have you take that first.
It's a low grade because you're banking on the person who's training the students to have a passion for DEI. That's literally what it is. And many people have a different viewpoint of what you should be focused on. Yes, there's a baseline of the things that you should be doing, but you're banking on that the person teaching the course is passionate about DEI and knows enough about what's happening right now. It's not teaching something 10 years ago or 5 years ago that they're doing their continuing education credit in that or going to the conferences and that sort of thing. The other thing is we have to get students to understand that DEI is bigger, deeper than just the racial pieces. We're talking global things that are happening and you have to be a global competent counselor, a global competent mental health provider, and many times they're not. So they're not meeting their clients where they are. And then we have like mental health, the counseling association, ACA has counseling competencies that they're required to follow. They have that in the code of ethics as well. But again, you're relying on the person providing the services to feel like that is important enough or can even recognize that is what's going on with them and the client, or that's important to, yes, you can teach it, that it should be integrated, but how many people are doing that? And yes, we have accreditation and that sort of thing. But I mean, when I go to the conferences and even I made it a spotlight. So I was so passionate about it. That is one of my spotlights as president to focus on DEI, JEDI, Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion is one of the spotlights. And people still didn't understand why it was so important because they were like, well, why are you focused on that? I'm like, it's that important. We need to focus on that. The president of the counseling association needs to be talking about it. I would say it's low. And that's heartbreaking as someone who's very passionate about that and teaches the course. I was so passionate about it. I created an advanced multicultural course at my institution. So that they can get additional stuff in that. So students can get additional multicultural pieces in that.
Kind of a follow-up to that point, and I appreciate your response there. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do to change the tide to get greater representation across race, gender, ethnicity, geographical location from your perspective, especially what you're seeing in your vantage point.
I think it goes back to that training piece. I know that at the conferences, making that a focal point at the conference, and they do, I think saying more than just your continuing ed or more than just you could go at the conference, it needs to be at the institutional level and not just in counseling programs. What we are currently doing at LSU Health Sciences is integrating that throughout the health sciences. So it's not just what we discovered, and this is my administrative hat. What we discovered is that the counseling students had a specific class geared towards multicultural counseling. None of the other areas, and we're 9 schools, had anything like a specific course that was geared toward that. They talked about it, yes, but there's not a course that you're taking that you get a grade in that is being assessed at some point. It's just across the, you know, across the curriculum. So now they are integrating it throughout. So you have it, they're trying to figure out ways to integrate it throughout the curriculum so that they're doing more integrative stuff. So it's counseling students within the 9, like not just the counseling students, but the other students in the other 9 schools are trying to integrate themselves together so that they're all coming to the table saying, well, this is what we learned. How does that impact the client? So they're looking at, we have a physician's assistance program. So if you have one client, what is the counseling piece of that? What is the physician assistance piece of that? What is the occupational therapy piece of that? What is the physical therapy piece of that? And how does it relate to multiculturalism, right? How does it relate to doing diversity, equity, and inclusion? So I actually sit on I'm the chair of the JEDI committee. So we're working on that and getting training and saying, not only do we want the students to do it, the faculty need to be trained in it. The staff need to be trained in it. And how do we get training from people that are not faculty and staff at LSU, but people that are coming in to train us?
That's wonderful. Where are you finding the hours in the day? That's right. Yeah, that's incredible.
I was gonna make a comment too that I worked in a racially diverse community, Muskegon, Michigan, for about 3 decades, providing psychological services, and I did reasonably well. My African American patients often seemed to benefit, but they often struggled also to see me as a white counselor. And several pastors came to me and said, "Can't you get an African-American psychiatrist or counselor in here?" And we hired, we recruited, and we hired, and every time we had one, they were hired away by an institution that was able to pay them more. So it is a struggle.
I had a question and a suggestion, if I may.
Please, briefly, yes.
My clientele, patients are generally diverse from all backgrounds, and most recently, a lot of veterans, both American GIs and Afghani, say, interpreters and GIs who live in New Mexico, they tell me that they feel less secure in Albuquerque than they did in the battlegrounds in Kabul. And wow. The reason is so many homeless people, mentally ill, substance user, dual diagnosis, basically, and not much is being done. I wonder if Saberg can come up with a think tank to come up with a solution to the problem of homelessness. It's a mess out here. Stores are closing. People are afraid of going to stores. People are afraid of going out in the dark, etc. Just a mess. Is it possible to have a think tank going?
Dr. Munshi, I've taken the note down, and that is something we should talk about for sure. Whether it's Los Angeles or in our rural communities, we're seeing homelessness skyrocket, and I agree with you, and I appreciate the point you've made. Perhaps we can circle back to our panelists at the end if we have time to speak to this very issue.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Don.
I'd like to make one other point just on the whole issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that is the interesting article about a week and a half ago in NBC News online about Asian Americans turning to Tai Chi online services because they're not, it's culturally alien to sit down and do talk therapy, at least talk therapy as we're now doing it. So one of the commentators was a professor who said, in an ideal world, a practitioner would be able to encourage a holistic approach where they might engage in some talk therapy mixed with cultural or indigenous healing practices, mixed with being mindful of diet, nutrition, physical activity, and whatever the person's religious practices are. So I think we have to look at BIPOC communities, persons of color, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and the model of mental health isn't going to be the same. Fortunately, some of the complementary therapies have more credibility in those communities.
Great. Thank you, Don. Dr. Davis, did you want to contribute to this part as well?
Do the DEI piece, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I just, you know, the only thing that Dr. Fraser said it well, is training. And I guess one of the things that, you know, even if you think about the community mental health system, which was born in the 60s as a result of JFK saying, we want to give voice to the voiceless, which at that point in time were individuals suffering from mental health issues, intellectual disabilities, and addictions concerns. He wanted them to have a life full of dignity. And yet today, what we do is we check a box on DEI. And I think people utilize and say to themselves that, hey, this is something that we need to really think through from a recruitment point of view, because providers want to be a part of an organization that has belonging at its forefront. But I would also say that we need to signal to the community as a provider group that it's a safe place for people to receive services. And I think that's what we have found over the course of time, is that fostering that sense of safety in a community as a provider is extremely important. And so DEI is not just a business decision, it's a relationship decision with your community. That's the only thing I wanted to add, so thank you.
Really terrific. Thank you to all the panelists. Dr. Hamilton, I'll turn it back over to you.
Appreciate that. Absolutely, thank you for that. The next question is kind of adding on to what you all are saying. And so I would like to ask the panelists, there was a recent report from the Department of Labor suggesting that by 2035, there will be a significant mental health provider shortages across the mental health professions. So panelists, what is needed to address the supply issue to meet America's integrative mental health needs? And one of the things that I want to start off by saying is we mentioned some already, including training of people, but I wanted to add, someone wrote, our JEDI chairperson, Gina Belton, wrote in chat that capacity building is also needed, as well as training. So I just wanted you all to reflect on that and then give us a response as to what's needed.
I would say funding, grants, resources for people who are choosing the mental health profession and making it affordable. Because the other thing is, it's not affordable currently. It doesn't feel like it's affordable to students to pick counseling or pick a mental health profession unless you are doing additional training and getting a PhD in it versus, so counselor education, your master's is your terminal degree. And oftentimes the students can't afford the payback part of their education with, you know, the federal government. So if loan forgiveness, partnering with other entities, I think is also a major thing that we need to do, is partnering with other entities that can give those resources, can give the funding, can give the grants that's outside of the federal government or outside of the known sources. So as president, I really worked with the American Association of Sports Psychologists, because we have an interest group that's sports counseling, to figure out how can we partner together to meet those needs. And I'm also working with Dr. David Carr, who is the president of the United Soccer Coaches Association, to figure out how to look at counseling from the perspective of the coaches and what they might see in their athletes. But again, we really, ACA, the American Counseling Association, is really working hard to find other entities that we can partner with to amplify mental health counseling and to figure out how can we better get these numbers up and get people more interested in it. We're also working with HBCU Cares with SAMHSA, where we're looking at Black and Brown graduates who are choosing mental health professions and helping them find grants and resources and getting them into training programs that are going to help them be better counselors and be able to go out there in the field.
Great, excellent point. Thank you.
I was going to address that from the standpoint of APA, American Psychological Association. APA is recognizing the problem. Right now, a recent survey said that 60% of psychologists have no openings for new patients, 60%. And yet the APA template for training requires full-time studies. You can't go part-time. Our PhD in social work program has largely part-time because the students are almost all working full-time. So we need to look at the training models. The positive thing that APA is doing is that, unlike counseling and social work, APA has long given credibility only to the doctoral level professionals. There are licensure in many states for master's level people, but it's often restricted practice and under supervision. And about 2.5 years ago, APA finally approved an accreditation process for master's programs for independent practitioners at the master's level. So that will slowly address the problem, but we're way behind. We're behind the eight ball here.
Thank you for that, Dr. Moss. Dr. Davis.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's really, really important is when you look at reciprocity of licenses across the United States, it's a challenge. We have this vehicle, you may have heard of it, called virtual care. Although regulations rarely catch up with clinical practice and the needs of the people, license becomes a real problematic endeavor when somebody moves across state lines. Not only that, when they get licensed in the state, it takes way too long, sometimes 3 to 6 months, as we have a waiting list that is extremely long. And Dr. Moss is right, 60% of centers, that's 3,000 community mental health centers across the country, have a wait list right now. That's just unacceptable, yet we can't get people licensed fast enough. You know, Dr. Fraser also mentioned reimbursement. It's really important to think about. It's really important to be advocates. We're not the best advocates on the financial side in our industry. 10 years ago, everybody wanted to work for a federally qualified health center called FQHCs because they had great rates. And now we have this thing in the mental health industry called Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, started by Senator Deb Stabenow out of Michigan and Roy Blunt out of Missouri, where you actually get reimbursed for what it costs to deliver service versus a fee-for-service model. And what that's done now across 10 states has made us have the ability to compete in wages. The psychologist 10 years ago in Missouri, believe it or not, started out at $50,000. Now a psychologist in the state of Missouri is over $100,000, largely related to CCBHC. Now more people are able to get paid competitive wages, which I hope at the end will drive more people in terms of prospective providers into our industry. So reimbursement models.
Yeah, that's very important, CJ. In West Michigan, there are very few psychiatrists who will see Medicare patients because the Medicare process is so cumbersome and the rates are lower. So if it's hard enough, we do not have enough psychiatrists anyway. And then they're busy seeing self-pay and commercial insurance patients.
Well, now the interesting thing with this new CCBHC, Medicaid and Medicare have a friendlier rate than commercial. So you see a lot of states that are building really great infrastructure for the Medicaid population. But what's next to fall is, how are we going to negotiate with third-party payers in the commercial space to match those rates? Because the work we do is important. It is a healthcare service. And yet we're often discriminated based upon the fees for reimbursement. Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to talk about the counseling compact. We're really excited about that, finally getting that off. We have at least 26 states in there. We would like to have all 50, but we know it's going to be a process in that. But it's so encouraging to know that that many states are now on, and that we've gotten our commissioners out there working. The hope is that we will have portability, at least with 26 states up and running in a year. So that's the hope, that as long as you're licensed in one of those 26 states, that you can then work in the states that are within the compact. And that'll help a little bit of allowing their having mental health services across states as well.
That's terrific. Thank you all for that. I think we're getting the framing just beautifully in terms of understanding the scope of both the supply and the demand side, some of the you know, innovations, but also the frustrations, as you've all pointed out, within that. I was just on my way out here reading a couple of books by Dr. James Lake. If I know Don, you're probably familiar with him, Integrative Health and Focus in that space. And the title of our panel here today focuses on integrative mental health. Dr. Moss, I'm going to direct this to you to start, but I'd like, of course, our other panelists to cue in here, because it's not just in the purview of one area. Can you please discuss for us what integrative mental health exactly is and how it is actualized in different practices?
Thank you, Nathan, for that question. And I'm going to discuss it looking at integrated and integrative. We're doing a little better on integrated, but we're not doing so well yet on integrative. The thesis of integrative health care, including mental health care, is that the human being is mind, body, and spirit, and that the treatment should address all aspects of that person. So we should be providing nutritional interventions that are supportive of mental health. We should be providing mind-body practices, meditation, imagery, and other forms of mind-body practices that are beneficial in self-care in between mental health episodes. There are a lot of body therapies from yoga to Tai Chi to Feldenkrais, Hannah Somatics, that are beneficial for mental health problems. And then the spiritual dimension. Now, what's happened is that we're getting some integrated care centers in which primary care is located with psychiatry and with other medical specialties, sometimes also with behavioral health, meaning counseling and psychotherapy. But there's very little inclusion of the more integrative therapies, the complementary therapies, except in some of the major centers like the Osher centers around the country. And there you get hypnosis, you get biofeedback, you get meditation training, you get nutrition, and other therapies, energy therapies in some centers. And people respond to them. Now, you're not going to treat a schizophrenic episode with Reiki energy therapy. But in between schizophrenic episodes, if the person is learning some self-care and making some lifestyle adjustments, they're less likely to have another episode as soon or as severely. So I think we need to look at getting all of those elements available to more parts of the community. We have a integrative nutrition program at Saybrook, and in the first year, the students already were saying, this stuff is too good. It shouldn't only be for the affluent. So a lot of our faculty now are involved with an organization called Integrative Medicine for the Underserved, looking at ways that we can make available integrative care for low-income people, for all parts of the community, urban areas, rural areas. And I think the population is open to those complementary therapies. I visit little remote towns in Michigan, and I see that they've got crystals and magnets. They don't have the evidence-based forms of complementary therapy, but people are looking for something.
CJ, what about yourself? What does integrative health, mental health look like to you?
If you ask 10 people, you're going to get 10 different definitions of integrative health. I will tell you that I recently talked with an individual, and they wanted to talk with me about our integrated models. And And we started talking a little bit. I asked them about theirs and they said, yeah, we're at a primary care office and we have that mental health provider down in the end of the hallway and you can schedule separately. And I said, oh, so you're co-located. And they said, no, we're integrated. So, you know, I think integrated means lots of different things to lots of different people. You know, from our vantage point, I look at integrated as mostly how do we take access points? In other words, how do people, a large front door into care and put them in the community where they naturally and organically visit, you know, whether that's a crisis center, whether that's a school, whether that's a primary care setting. And so we do a lot of your traditional integrated services, behavioral health consultant, warm handoff models in primary care settings and our fully integrated FQs, as well as in our school-based services. We have federally qualified health centers offering primary care alongside behavioral health care embedded in our school wellness model, and that's integrated. And so I think, heck, you could have a clinic and a library with a virtual primary care provider, behavioral health therapist, and that may be integrated because it's where an access point is needed. It's where our clients, those that we want to serve, are located. You know, in the school settings especially, we spend a lot of time thinking about integrated services, whether that's our autism center or in a school, and how do we integrate that? Because we know that when a kid first experiences a psychiatric symptom, they have to wait 6 to 8 years for care. We also know that 70% of mental health services that kids receive today are in a school system. So it's not what I would call medical integration, but it's embedded in a way that we're trying to wrap services around a kid in their everyday organic life to better meet their needs.
Co-location is more than just being under the same roof. I was in 1983, I started a behavioral health clinic within a primary care. And we had lunch together. We would pass in the hallway. My patients knew the doctors. They knew the nurses. And the level of follow through on referrals was so much higher because the doc could come and get me and bring me into the examining room and introduce me and say, Dr. Moss does a lot with our headache patients and they seem to do very well. And then I would walk them down to my office and have an initial contact and then follow through was good. If you're across town or somewhere distant, the follow through on referrals is much lower. And I agree, embedding in other ways makes sense too.
If we refer somebody to an integrated person, a colleague, the psychologist, as an example, a BHC in our primary care setting, patients have a 90% chance of following up. They have a 10% chance of following up if we refer them to a specialty clinic across town. And I think that's important. And the other thing that is often unstated in terms of the importance of integration is data analytics. And what I mean by that is, how do you risk stratify those people that come into clinics and have higher needs or more complex needs? And then how do you deploy services that are integrated, whether that's a nurse, a community health worker, a community-based worker, whatever that may be, virtual psychiatrist, whatever that patient needs based upon the data and their frequency and where they go seek care where they really shouldn't be. So I think, you know, the often unsung hero in all of this is, how do we use data to enrich and advance and inform our integrative practices?
That's a 21st century example of what I saw in my internship, Dr. Davis. I did my internship at the University of Pittsburgh Health Center at the Staunton Clinic, which was a psychiatric clinic within a large outpatient medical clinic. And the criteria, when the chart got thicker than this, the patients were introduced to the Staunton Clinic. And It was data analytics in a primitive form, but most of those patients' medical usage of medical services in the Falk Clinic went down very rapidly once they made the connection with behavioral health staff.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you both. Dr. Frazier, did you want to weigh in here on integrated mental health?
I can. I think that I worked really hard as president to kind of get that concept going for our members, in the sense that we had people who, we had a neuroscience person that worked medical, was in a medical field, actually be a speaker, one of our speakers, to kind of see how this integrates with what we're doing. And they talk specifically about burnout. I think part of the problem is that we have to get counselors thinking about how do they do integrative stuff, and that they get out of that silo of we're only doing this. And that's what we're working really hard to do as well, to get them to think about, like, how are you using other things to kind of tackle your burnout? How are you, you know, doing other services? Because we can't expect our clients to do things that we're not doing, right? And then how is that integrated in the coursework too? So our counselor educators, are you actually teaching integrative stuff? And most times if you ask them, they're not. Most times they're not looking at, I think I'm at a very unique place where it's a school of allied health. So I see all these allied health people, but that's a unique experience. Most people won't have that experience. Because even our students, we have a program where they follow each other, like all of the schools, the students are in a class together for a year or 2 years, depending on which program. And they talk about how they would help a client from all points with their particular discipline. I think that needs to happen more often in programs so that you're graduating people who think from that perspective already versus having to reteach them that. And then those who are already out there are members that are already out there, getting them to kind of think about that. But again, I always say we need to pour into the people that are coming out, because they will do the change. If they're doing it, then people follow that, because then it becomes antiquated if you're not on that train.
So this question is directed at Dr. Davis, and I would like to ask the others to respond as well. But rural America's integrative mental health needs differ from the high density urban and coastal areas. Can you describe these challenges in more depth and how your organization is working to address these at the regional and local levels? So basically, where do you see the opportunities and challenges in partnering with higher education and professional accreditors and increasing supply and expanding access?
Well, I'll try to unpack that. And President Long indicated when I had an opportunity to talk about rural mental health that this would at least be about a 1 hour answer. So gear up for my crash course here. So, you know, we spend a lot of time working in rural areas, and a lot of people don't realize that if you look at the prevalence rate of mental health conditions across rural and urban areas, they're about the same. What's different is access, whether it's mental health literacy, transportation, stigma, you know, the access in rural areas, availability of providers is where we really start to get impacted. About 65% of non-metropolitan areas, counties do not have a licensed mental health provider. Rural Missouri, as an example, a state that I know well, probably in rural California, there's many areas that have no mental health provider anywhere. And then so if you think about just the roots of the rural areas, it's a kind of do it on your own, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. A lot of people don't realize that one of the highest at-risk groups for suicide is farmers. Now, why is that? Because it's a very isolated profession, on your own, you do it yourself mentality. And so we have found that one of the best strategies is to partner with academic institutions. In fact, it may be the only strategy, frankly, that we have found effective. And what happens generally is we find some way that through our marketing efforts, we find that individual that's from a rural area that's training at a local university and wants to go back to their home rural area. And that person's like jackpot golden, because then we can throw money at them to get them to go back to their home area. And usually it's not a whole lot of persuasion. We in our organization, we have about 150 people in training at any given moment in time. We have medical students, psychiatrists, pre-doc interns, master's students, practicum students, people in supervision for licensure. And the data is overwhelming. In fact, I want to read some of the data because I think it's really important. In fact, the data is so overwhelming that we partnered with our local academic institution, Missouri State University, starting this fall, to start a CIDE program where we become the exclusive, almost exclusive training partner for them from a practicum perspective. That's how much we've invested in the academic institutions. And we have many of them that we call our premier, our preferred academic institutions. So these are some of the stats that are interesting. About 51% of a clinical student that comes to our organization ends up being a clinical provider in our space after their conclusion of their graduate training. About 40% at the bachelor's level, if they walk into our doors, end up working as a case manager in our community. And about 40% of our pre-doctoral interns, psychologists — I'm a psychologist by training, but psychologists actually stay and want to be employed. And when they stay for multiple years, especially on the psychology front. But here's the other interesting thing, and another reason why to partner with academic institutions. Of our employees who engage in training — and we have a lot of supervisors, we have over 600 therapists and supervisors in our organization — those who train, they have an 86% retention rate, which means that once they engage and they give back to the field and they're engaged in this training experience to give back to another human that is going through what they just went through at some time in their career, they have a higher chance of wanting, or a higher percentage of retention. And also, if you look at that across disciplines, whether that's psychologist, LCSW, or a licensed professional counselor, all of our retention rates are higher when they engage in training. So it's very clear that to us, in order to find them, we can either grow them on our own, or we can raid them from other entities. It always pays off, especially in rural areas, because of the retention. And the academic partnerships, we believe, is the key to building a workforce.
I think you could have gone on for about an hour.
Those are impressive numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that. All right. Dr. Davis, did you want to respond, please? Then Dr. Moss.
I think you meant Dr. Frazier, right?
I am so sorry, Dr. Frazier. I'm looking at her. Dr. Frazier, I'm so sorry.
I think it's the partnership that Dr. Davis talked about. I mean, you're not going to get people interested unless they have a vested interest. I mean, that happens with New Orleans. That happens with any of the entities in Louisiana. They have to have a vested interest in some way. That's the vested interest that you're from there. And you're more willing to take a lower pay to get out there into your own community and make a difference. I mean, that's what we hear over and over again when we're dealing with people who are coming into the program. Like, why are you interested in the program? What do you want to do? They emphatically say, I want to get this degree so I can go back to my community and do work in my community. And that's all over. New Orleans is not rural, but most of the areas in Louisiana are very rural. So that's a benefit that they're wanting to go back out and do that.
The other opportunity is hybrid care. We've got so many medical centers now sponsored by University of Michigan, Trinity Health, or one of the other major chains. A lot of our smaller towns now have these primary care clinics with visiting specialists periodically, and we can do the same thing with mental health. My clinic when I had a large multi-center site, we would put therapists into primary care offices. And we only had to be there about a day a week, because if we would make the first connection, the patients would typically come to our centers where we had more therapists. And if we do that in rural areas, make that first connection, many of the patients are happy to do telehealth after that. You've established rapport, and teletherapy is working fairly well with some fairly disturbed people. I mean, I'd like to put somebody every day in each one of those medical clinics, and maybe we'll eventually do that. But for now, that's one way to reach rural populations.
Thank you so much. Before we lose out any more time, I have a burning question that I'm going to direct to Dr. Frazier and then to the group. So interestingly, the hot button topic right now is access and, you know, to education, to training. And we've seen a lot of barriers to that, especially the accreditor level at the, you know, access level in terms of innovation around modality, you know, whether it's online or hybrid or in person. And not to be hypercritical here, but the APA accrediting arm has been a real tough cookie in this area. And I, a lot of credit to the KCREP for being more expansive, I think, in their training and worldview in terms of opportunities there. And yet, I think we could do and see a lot better outcomes in terms of this area. Dr. Fraser, I'm going to kick it to you first. What's the ACA? And then I know you're not, you have some interface with KCREP, I'm sure. What are your thoughts on this? Yeah.
So I can't really speak to KCREP only as like a department chair and someone delivering actual coursework. I will say that as you are frustrated with the arm of APA, I would contend counselors. Counselor educators are frustrated with KCREP in many ways. It's almost a, when you say, oh, we're going through a KCREP study or a KCREP visit, it's this automatic like cringe or like, oh my goodness, I don't, oof, okay, tell us more. It's almost like they need counseling. The people going through it need counseling too. So I would say yes, KCREP, because of the pandemic, expanded some stuff that they weren't doing before. I'm not sure that that's going to remain in place now that we are out of that and we're awaiting the new standards. They're coming out with new standards, so we're waiting to see what that looks like. I know ACA really tries to partner with higher education institutions because we have counselor educators that make up about 2 or 3% of our membership. But the other thing is we want to partner with mental health institutions and just partner with our members that are out there providing services, because that's the bulk of our membership, is the people out there doing private practice, the people out there that are in mental health agencies and that sort of thing, to really get an idea of what they want and what is important to them. The accrediting body part, I mean, I'm going to just say this as a professor. I'm not sure this, it's one of those things that they're like, can you do it? You know, like, can you do the work that we asked you to do? Can you do the services? And then clients are concerned more about how do you deliver the care of it? I think that's what makes the compact, the counseling compact, so important, because they want to be able to deliver the services. The accreditation piece, I think, I just think we're going to have to really look at that. Like, I think we really have to think about what is the accreditation piece for, and how do we make it more accessible for our Hispanic serving institutions, our HBCUs, because it's expensive to get accredited. And we need them to kind of look at that part too. It's expensive in the money part, it's expensive in the man hours of the faculty that have to do the reporting and produce the things that they're looking at. And that is something that the membership is really advocating for too. Like, are you doing what you say that you're doing as it relates to DEI? Like, you want us to have that, but are you making it affordable for those institutions that would turn out these people that would be at these specific institutions? And that's something that we are still looking at and still after for.
Yeah, I appreciate that response very much. I think it's a thicket that it's hard to crawl out of for sure and figure out the way forward. But a lot of opportunity for partnership to, you know, with APA and KCREP to explore opportunities to see them as partners. Dr. Davis, on that point, any thoughts from you?
Nothing that I think has already been said, but thank you.
You got it. You got it. Dr. Moss?
I will say something in that direction. First of all, I have to say that the KCREP graduates that I've interacted with are so much of such a higher quality than the counseling graduates 10 years ago. The template really does force a very comprehensive education in counseling. So I've been impressed. The downside of that is that the template is so full and so tight We have in my college an integrative mental health curriculum that runs everything from integrative nutrition to lifestyle medicine to mind-body skills, meditation courses, imagery courses, hypnosis. And the counseling master's students cannot take those courses because their template is so tight. On the other hand, we have an integrative mental health specialization in one of our doctorates, and we get a lot of master's level social workers and counselors coming in and doing this PhD. They have their license, they have their terminal degree, and now they get a degree which allows them to learn a lot of these add-ons, which are very beneficial to the patient and to the professional. But how we could, I don't know whether it's, you don't want to extend the master's degree and make it so many more credits that it can be both a highly competent counseling degree plus all these other goodies that are useful.
I mean, we couldn't even add our specialty. We were doing specialty classes, what you were talking about. And because of how KCRAP writes the, what you have to do, we had to take those out because there was, it's like, are we getting you a master's? Are we getting you an EDS? Are we getting you?
Yeah. Like,
what are we doing?
Well, any APA template is just as tight.
Right, right. I think that it's nice too that students are able to, upon graduation, you can attend trainings and get certificates and things of that sort. But it's always nice when you're at an institution to get everything you can. But you're right. KCRAP is a little bit rigid in that stance with the curriculum, and that's one of the downsides, I think. But I agree with Nathan in the sense that we. And I can speak for KCRAP because that's in my area, my wheelhouse, but I really do enjoy the teachings, the courses, and then the way we streamline DEI and a lot of wonderful things throughout each course. It's not just in one course, it's all the way through. And I think that's an intentional part that we do, and I'm very proud of that. And so I think, Dawn, when you say that some of the graduates in counseling for the last 10 years, you can see how well educated they are, I think, and trained. I think because KCRAP and counseling programs did a lot of work on curriculum and teaching. And so I think that's a really good thing. We still have miles and miles, I think, to go. When we're talking about APA and online hybrid learning, I think KCRAP is, you know, we've been at the helm maybe 20, 30 years now. And that is a bit different than some other accreditations, but we're still not all there yet, right? And so that's still an issue. Because we know that if we can help students or help clients and patients by using virtual platforms, then why not teach our, you know, why not be able to teach them that way as well? So I like to tell students when I was teaching that 30 years ago, when I was in my master's program, we had two sentences in our textbook about online counseling, and look at what's happening now. You know, we never thought that this would be the way it is. And I appreciate you, Dr. Frazier, for mentioning those things. And Dr. Davis and Dr. Moss, very, very good.
I want to thank Dr. Frazier, Dr. Davis, and Dr. Moss for their time today on this panel. I hope you learned so much from them. We have much more to do, as is clear, especially as we impact the state of mental health in America, as well as integrative mental health and how we advance the health and well-being of our communities. So stay tuned, more to come. If you want to see the YouTube version of the panel, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you know what to do. Go to Apple or Spotify, leave that 5-star rating, and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, also subscribe to us on all major podcast platforms, including Google, Amazon, Stitcher, and the like. Remember to check our show notes for this. In the show notes, you'll find links to our guests and to other vital information. And for more about Saybrook University, all you need to do is go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on areas of study at the top of the page and locate the program of your choice to learn more, or go to our Unbound website to read from many of the thought leaders you heard from today and elsewhere. You're going to find a lot of good stuff on there. We'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us for this very special panel presentation.